Good evening. Oops. Good evening, everyone. How are you doing? Well, welcome again to CORE. As always, I want to make a special welcome for those people who might be new among us, and a special welcome if you are even just new. Christianity hasn't been something you've had too much exposure to, that it would be cool if you were here. We're so glad that you're here. And feel free to speak at your table or not speak if you're new here. It's great to have you. The lectures have been recorded, or the talks have been recorded. The most important part of our night, of course, is table discussion. But so that's not recorded. But the talks have been recorded, and you can listen to those. But in many ways, our talk series is self-contained. In other words, each talk, though it fits within a bigger theme, is standalone. So if you're here for the first time tonight, we're really glad you're here, and it's all good. Well, tonight, we are going to be winding things back a little bit in our study on relationships, our study on families, our study of our relationships as Christians with others in light of our culture around us. We keep talking each week about the fact that it's amazing, and I'm not sure if any period in history is like this, where we actually have a word for how to break down a relationship, you know, that we can cancel somebody. And so we talked about the fact that the leadership team, when we were planning on what to talk about in this series, and we decided that, you know, we have to talk about relationships. And we decided this could very well be the most important series that we've had in CORE so far. We're talking about the importance of relationships. Now, we're going to be, we started off in our first 2 weeks by talking kind of about some theory. We talked about God being love and the importance of love and what does love actually mean. We looked at Romans chapter 12. And then we moved in our second two talks into talking about stories of people's lives. Now, these stories weren't real stories. They were Jesus telling a parable. So he was telling a parable about some people. So it was kind of a made-up story, but still it came from Jesus, and they were excellent stories. Tonight, we are going to be looking at real stories. We're going to be starting over the next 3 weeks looking at real people's lives, individuals who lived in history, and what they can tell us about relationships. Now, all of these people are in the Bible, of course, that's why we're here, looking at the Bible. And I'd invite you actually in the Bible to open up to 1 Samuel, just the very beginning of 1 Samuel. We're going to be looking at 1 Samuel 1 and 1 Samuel 2. And again, if you're visiting here with a friend and you don't have a Bible, that's no problem at all. You can look on with the person next to you. That would be fantastic. Now today, we're going to be starting our talk on people's real lives with two characters, Eli and Samuel. And you might say to yourself, why are we putting these two people together? Are they related? Is one the father? Is one the son? And we're going to see that, no, they're not related. Eli and Samuel aren't blood relatives. But there's a sense in which Samuel was like an adopted child, an adopted son to Eli. Because see, what happens is, as we'll see in just a second, Hannah, Samuel's mom, prays to the Lord, and we're going to take a look at that in just a second, and she decides that she is going to promise her son to God and that she is going to have him live from a certain age on in the tabernacle with the high priest. And Eli is the high priest. So as you can see, Eli is kind of like a foster father to Samuel. And so they have a relationship together, Eli and Samuel. Now Eli himself has physical sons. But as we're going to see, his physical sons are a bit of a train wreck. And in fact, Samuel, when he grows up to become a man, he has children as well. And his sons are also a train wreck. Great, we're off to a great start. So we're talking about cancel culture. God actually cancels both groups. He cancels the sons of Eli, and he cancels out the sons of Samuel. So we're talking about cancel culture. We're going to actually see tonight God canceling people. And see what's up with that and what do we do with that. But what happens next is that Samuel, because his sons don't follow him, the people try to cancel God. That's crazy, isn't it? They use this as an opportunity to say, you know what, God is our king, but we actually want a physical king. And so there's an attempt to cancel God. So all of this sounds like a bit of a mess, doesn't it, really? Doesn't sound like the funnest story. Doesn't sound like the most wonderful, encouraging, exciting story. But it's a mess worth looking at. Because relationships are messy, aren't they? And you've got to love that about the Bible. The fact that the Bible presents things in real terms. You have real people with real struggles, with real messes. And so as we look at the real messes that exist in this story, we're going to see some things that will help us to understand the messiness in our stories, how we can avoid our stories being messy, our relationships being messy with other people. So our topic for tonight, as it has been throughout this course, is relationships. And what does the Bible have to say about relationships? And again, we're going to be able to take a look by looking at the lives of Eli and Samuel tonight. Well, there's a lot to cover, and we're going to have to be a little selective, but let's just launch straight into it. The first point I want to talk about, just ever so briefly, just like a matter of 1 or 2 minutes, or even less, is the idea that the era in which we're talking about, the era in which Eli and Samuel lived in, was an era that was totally messed up. It was this period called the period of the judges. And you had all of these people who were, quite frankly, a bunch of losers. And they were the leaders of Israel, right? I mean, if you've ever heard the story of Samson, Samson gets dramatized in kids' stories and stuff, but Samson was a bit of a loser, right? He goes out and does all kinds of terrible things, and yet he's kind of the pinnacle. He's the best of the best during this difficult and painful period of the judges. You know, if we could just apply that briefly now, we realize that there are seasons, aren't there? And some seasons are good and some seasons are pretty dark. And, you know, understanding that when seasons get dark, then things do get very messy. And so that's the context of this season. This was a season of darkness in the history of Israel. Okay, so first point, we're navigating into Eli and Samuel's lives, and we start off by realizing, okay, they live at a pretty bad time. The second thing I want to talk about, though, is the way that 1 Samuel starts. And 1 Samuel starts with the story about a faithful mother. Okay, let me just put in a plug for mothers here. Mothers don't get enough credit. I'm not just saying that to win the mothers here on side, but I think it's true. Looking at my own wife and the work that she does, and I just realized how, I mean, it took me like, my mum's 80th birthday, I stood up and I said, thank you. Thank you for this, thank you for that, thank you for that. And there were things that I just had never even thanked my mum for. Now, I'm a parent, I realize, whoa, I was painful to my parents, you know, in this way and this way. So, mothers. We start off the story with a mother who is a hero, which is really cool. And her name is Hannah. Now, to summarize just a little bit of what happens in Hannah's life, and if you're looking in your Bible there, you'll see in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 3, there is a man who used to go up year by year from his city to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, there's Eli introduced, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. Now remember, Hophni and Phinehas, they're the losers, they're the bad sons, right? So we're going to come back to them in just a second. Now one day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife. Remember, in those days, there were certain Jewish laws where people would marry more than one wife. And so it was in the case of Elkanah. Peninnah, his wife, and his sons and daughters. But Hannah, this is his other wife, he would give double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. And her rivalry used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. Now it seems like that is the other wife. So here we go. There's already a family drama going on here. Peninnah is giving Hannah a hard time because she doesn't have any children. And it says, so they went up year by year. As often as they went up to the house of the Lord, she would provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. here is a time of celebration. This is supposed to be the most amazing time. We're going up to celebrate, to feast. And what would she do? That were the very times when she was the most horrid to this other woman. Isn't that the way it often works in relationships? You know, the best times, the times that should be the best, can end up being the worst. It gets a little worse from here. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, the ever-sensitive husband, her husband says to her, "Hannah, why are you weeping and why do you not eat?" Starts off well. "And why is your heart sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? Not good, buddy, right? Good try. I'm sure the men in the room can relate to attempting to be encouraging to your wife, and those of us who are married and husbands, badly done, buddy. Sorry. So here's what I want you to notice, though. The narrator chooses not to record any words of Hannah. It doesn't tell you anything that Hannah says. The very first words that Hannah speaks, get this, this is important. The very first words that Hannah speaks in this whole storyline, which is usually very, very important, the first thing anybody ever says is that she prays. It never tells us that she responded to the other wife. It never tells us that she responded to her husband's attempts at encouragement towards her. No, the first thing that she speaks in the narrative is that she says she prays. And I think that's really cool, isn't it? Because when we think about relationships and we think about conflict, prayer is underrated. Prayer is, if I could put it in a culturally inappropriate terms, the bat phone, right? Sorry, that sounded goofy. But if you know anything about that, the DC character, Batman, Commissioner Gordon has a red phone and he can call Batman anywhere, anytime. And we have a direct communication with God. And so how often is it, though, that with our relationships, when we have difficulties in our relationships, the first thing we think to do is to confront, to gossip about, to complain about. And yet Hannah, the first thing she does is praise. That's what's recorded for us. And so here it is in verse 9 of our passage. It says, "After they had eaten and drunk at Shiloh," remember that's where the tabernacle is, "Hannah rose. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, 'O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on my affliction, on the affliction of your servant, and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head.'" In other words, he will be fully dedicated to the Lord. Hannah, this story starts out in this messy period of history with a woman who loves God and who prays. What a cool start. Now, the story, though, goes bad all of a sudden, almost immediately. Because Eli, who's there sitting in the temple, immediately assumes that as she's praying, she's drunk. Because she's mouthing these words, she's in anguish. And he immediately assumes that she's drunk. And you just kind of realize how pathetic the situation must be in that era. How much broken there must be. Because here's the guy who's supposed to be in the place of prayer, where everyone is actually gathering for prayer. And when somebody finally comes in as actually earnest in prayer, he just assumes that they're drunk. And so in verse 12, we read that he says, as she continued to pray, etc., verse 14, Eli rebukes her. He says, "How long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you." And Hannah has to plead her innocence. She says, "No, Lord, I'm a woman troubled in spirit. I have not drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. I have been speaking out of great anxiety and vexation." And then Eli answers her, "Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant the petition that is yours. Now, while it may seem at first like Eli's response is a good one, it is actually not that good. Because as a priest, what he was supposed to do was he was supposed to represent the people before God. He should have gone to her and said, "I'm so sorry. What are you praying for?" She's opened up her heart and said, "I'm praying, I'm in grief. Something is really vexing me, and I am pouring out my soul to God here." And all he can do is say to her, "May it be whatever you're asking that'll happen." He doesn't get involved in her life. He doesn't even try to find out what she's prayed. It's not interesting to him. And, you know, this just shows his attitude. Now, this then moves us on to Eli himself. And this third point I've got for you tonight is a failed father. When Eli is finally introduced, we see him act in interaction with Hannah and interacting really badly. And what we read next is that the sons of Eli were worthless men, verse 12 of chapter 2. If you're over in chapter 2, they did not know the Lord. You know, this is such a tragedy, isn't it? When people who are supposed to be leading can't lead. When those people are supposed to be leading people to God, like this would be like saying an engineer who knows nothing about engineering, right? A doctor who knows nothing about medicine, a dentist who knows nothing about dentistry. To try to lead somebody in a direction and to know nothing about it is just pathetic. And what ends up happening is we realize that these guys are absolutely brutish. What they end up doing, we read in this section, they're stealing food, the best food for themselves. If a person comes and says, no, that's not the way it's supposed to happen. Somebody who's not even a leader among the people is more spiritual than them. They say, doesn't God say that you're not supposed to take the best food? It says they just grab it off them. They say, no, give it to me now. And they take it by force. So here they are, manhandling people who are coming to the temple. They're prodding around, and in the Hebrew it says they're poking is kind of like a gluttonous frenzy. They're looking for the best food. And we read later on that they're sleeping with the women in the temple who are there to serve God. And Eli does nothing about it. Well, in chapter 2, verses 22 to 25, he does speak to his sons, but it's this kind of cowardly, wimpy, you know, sort of like, oh, why are you doing these things, my son? You shouldn't do this. This is not appropriate. This is not the right thing. And then it just says they don't listen to the voice of their father. And it says that the Lord had determined that he was going to judge them and put them to death. Now, Eli's actions at first may seem just pathetic and wimpy, unmanly, and just, But it actually gets worse because you read on in chapter 2 that by the end of the chapter in verse 29, God speaks to Eli and challenges him about what he does. And in verse 29, it actually says, "You honor your sons above me," God says. And look at this, the next words, "by fattening yourselves." He doesn't just say fattening them, by them fattening themselves, by fattening yourselves as a family. See, later on we read that Eli is very fat. And so Eli is not rebuking his sons. He's not doing what he should be doing because he's getting a bit of the benefits of what he's doing. I warned you that this isn't a fun section, right? There's some difficult things here. But what I want to say, I just want to apply this straight away and say to you that, you know, oftentimes we talk about tough love, being willing to be tough. But it's all too easy to be tough with people you don't know. You see this all the time on social media, don't you? You see people with faceless individuals, with the crowds, you know, being really bold and speaking out as if, you know, wow, I'm being really cool and I'm being really tough. But tough love isn't just tough to others, it's tough to you. When you show tough love, the place that you are called to show tough love is in the place where you live, where you are at. Eli should have removed his sons. Eli should have kicked them out. Eli didn't want to do that because he didn't want his family line to lose the priesthood. But in the end, God says, because your sons are so evil, you're going to lose the priestly line. And over in 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 26 and 27, I won't read it. You can look and see that it says, Solomon expelled Abiathar, and this was to fulfill the words where he removed Eli's house completely. Eli's house had been 100% cancelled. And it was because Eli didn't have the guts to deal with his own family. And part of the problem was he didn't want to cancel himself, right? He didn't want to cancel himself. He didn't want to see his loved ones canceled. He didn't have the guts to speak to his own children. And he didn't have the guts to threaten his own self and his own family line. Let me ask you the question, you know, because what we're really doing in this series, we're saying you can't, when we're talking about culture around about us and people getting cancelled and people, you know, we can only start with ourselves, can't we? We can sort of, this is not a series about pointing the finger at other people and saying, you know, how do we try to adjust other people's relationships? How do we try to get other people to like us or whatever? We can only deal with what we have in front of us. We can only deal with ourselves. And what we realize is that this passage tells us something very challenging about being willing to even put ourselves at risk when it comes to tough love. Are we prepared to speak to the ones we love in a way that might threaten relationships? When was the last time that you spoke up to somebody, maybe a boyfriend or a girlfriend, maybe a spouse, and were prepared to bring up difficult topics? That's where it begins. That's where relationships begin. You know, it's all very well to kind of look and speak about other relationships and their dysfunctionality, but what about the relationships that you're in? If we're not prepared to start where we are with those relationships, whether they be friendships or whether they be family relationships, that will threaten not just our comfort, but the possibility of our own future. You know, think about sometimes with friendships, if we're willing to speak up and be bold, that can threaten those things. It's risky. But those kinds of risky confrontations are what the Bible calls us to have. So even as we're talking about cancel culture, one of the most dangerous things you can do within a climate where people are in the midst of and in the habit of canceling you if they don't like what you're saying, is to say things which they may not like. But what Eli is challenged with is, are you honoring God or are you honoring people and yourself? And honestly, that's what it comes down to so often. When it comes to our inability to speak the truth in love to other people who need that truth spoken, then, and we're not talking about doing it in a brazen and thoughtless way, but those things are the most threatening things. But if we honor God, He will honor us in those relationships. Okay, third point, a faithful son. We're on to the better news here. Eli was a problem. His sons were a problem. But Samuel was not. Remember we said that Samuel's mother, Hannah, was a woman of prayer. She comes and she talks to the Lord. Eli knows nothing about that. He doesn't even know how to relate to her when she says she's praying. He doesn't know how to ask him and encourage her and help her. He's not a godly man. Samuel, her son, we don't read of him praying, but we read of God speaking through him. So there's a really cool connection here. On the one hand, his mother is praying to God, and on the other hand, Samuel himself is receiving words from the Lord. Now in chapter 3, we read of this really fun incident where as a little boy, the Lord calls out to him while he's asleep, Samuel. He says, and he runs into Eli, he assumes that Eli is talking to him, and Eli says, it's not me, go back to bed. And then second time, Samuel goes in again to Eli, not me, go back to bed. Third time, and finally, you know, third time is usually a sign of fulfillment. It takes Eli three times, the perfect number of times, to realize what's going on. Again, he's not spiritual. And finally, he says, go back to bed, and when you hear it again, say, speak, your servant hears. And he does that, and God speaks to him. And what God says to him is, tell Eli that I'm about to judge his house. Right? Great. Just the vision you were wanting as a little boy towards your surrogate father, right? And so he gets this vision, and then Eli says to him, tell me what the Lord said. And he tells him everything. Hard word as it is. I'll tell you a funny, it's kind of a funny story. When I was in Australia, I was the youth pastor in a church, and the elders in the church were not very functional. Their families were a bit broken. And I talked to a friend who was a pastor, and I said, do you think I should say something? And he said, no, just pray. Pray that if the Lord would have you to say something, then he would open up the door. And so we came to the second last elders meeting before I was leaving. And the elders out of the blue, one of the elders out of the blue said, Bruce, we've so enjoyed having you working here on staff. Could you next elders meeting come along and give us an evaluation as elders about how you think we're doing, us and our families? I was like, wow, okay, be careful what you pray for. That was exactly what I had prayed for. So during the month in between, I prayed and I came and I said, Lord, if they want to forget, that's fine. But they didn't forget. And in the middle of the meeting, they said, tell us. We want to know. I said, okay. Well, I think I work with your son and I think that there's some not good things going on. You know, and I think... And it was kind of like you could have heard a pin drop. But then one of them turned to the other and said, well, we asked. And that must have been how Samuel was feeling. But he spoke up. He spoke the truth in love. And Eli's response is again, as you would expect, terrible. Because he doesn't repent. He ends up saying, oh, well, let the Lord's will be done. Like, que sera, sera. Whatever will be, will be. Which is always a bad answer when God challenges you about something. So look, let's tie things together here before we go to our tables discussion. And I want to apply all of this. First of all, there's a lot of relational dynamics going on here, isn't there? But let's notice this first of all when it comes to a relationship between humans and God. Notice that all the people who are willing to wrestle with God end up going well. All the people who couldn't care less about God go badly. All the people who try to work things out politically and try to just navigate their own relationships and not deal with things properly and not give up the gravy train of their own, you know, getting fat and all of those things. All of the people who treat God as if he doesn't exist, things go bad. And all of those who look to God, things go well. I know it just sounds like a no-brainer, but you've got to take God seriously, right? If you believe that God exists, you have to take God seriously. And that's what we see happening. Those people who take God seriously, their relationships with others end up being the way they should be. Difficult as they might be, they end up being good. And we need to realize that our relationships with others start with our relationship with God. Okay, others. Sin always messes up relationships. We used to have a little saying with our kids, what happens when you sin? Bad things happen, right? So it may not happen to you, it may not just happen to you, but it's like, what happens when you sin? Bad things happen. What happens when you trust God? Good things happen, right? And so, sin messes up relationships. And again, this might just seem so ridiculously simple, but sin so often feels like that little thing that we keep, like a little pet in the corner, like a little animal that we feed and we nourish, and it's enjoyable to us at times. And it's not enjoyable. It messes stuff up. Where does even the cancel culture come from? It comes from the fact that I'm the most important person. I have my views. If you don't listen to me, well, I don't want to know you. It comes from sin. So sin messes things up. But last thing I want to say here is that, speaking about God again, to put things in balance, what we finally realize is that Samuel's own sons fall off the wagon as well. In chapter 8, verse 3, we read that his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. And so what the people end up doing is, they end up saying that because your sons can't be good leaders, we want a human king. And we know that God is our king, but that doesn't matter. We want a human king. They use this as an opportunity to cancel out God. But get this. When it's all said and done, the human king that they end up getting eventually is David. And David ends up being the heir in the line for Jesus. And so Jesus in the New Testament ends up being in the line of David, the son of David. And so the whole storyline reaches this beautiful climax, doesn't it? Because even though all of this story is about messed up and broken relationships, and even though in the final analysis you would say that they've canceled God, how could it get any worse? God is able to take that, the worst possible moment in all of this story, and turn it around and turn it into something amazing and good. That it would be the means, them wanting a king would be the means by which he would send his son to be the true king, both God and man. And that he would come and he would die on the cross for our sins so that we would know eternal life, that our sins could be forgiven. He dealt with sin once and for all. So I know that this is not exactly a feel-good passage. There's some real brokenness in the relationships here. But I think that there's some wonderful truths to be learned even from the good figures in this story. There's some negative lessons to be learned from the bad figures in this story. But more importantly than everything, there are some lessons to be learned about God himself and the fact that God is able to redeem even the brokenness, even the most broken moment in this whole story where God himself is trying to be cancelled, that God can turn that around and do something good. Is it possible that God could turn around some of our cancelled cultural relationships? This passage tells us that he can. Let's go to our table discussion now.